You know, most of the time for most of us, if we were traveling across Wichita and we hit every red light, we would recognize that. Man, we hit every red light. But most of us, most of the time, if we hit every green light, we wouldn't notice it. It's just kind of a quirk of the nature of who we are. I say that because this morning, Rodney and Jim both talked about how God is attentive to us. And I think for me, if not for all of us, we can sometimes feel like, you know, if this is attentive, I would hate to see inattentive. Because we're asking him, we're getting red lights. I think part of that is because sometimes the things that we're getting red lights on are so important to us, so imminent in our minds, that they counteract all the green lights, all the ways God's saying yes in our lives. And any parent is going to have a fair number of yeses and nos with their child. The problem is, with a child, the no's always seem more profound to us than the yeses. So it's important not just to realize that God is attentive to us, it's equally important that we're attentive to him in a way that we don't just get frustrated with the red lights, but we remain grateful with the green lights. Ayn Rand, and sometimes you'll hear her called Ayn Rand, but her Russian author Ayn Rand has a really large and devoted following in America. Many years after she died, even in India, she remains a bestseller. She sold 29 million copies of her books. And in 92, 10 years after she died, Library of Congress and Book of the Month Club did a survey, and the respondents listed her as second behind the Bible in terms of influence in her life. She was a determined, outspoken atheist. If you love her work, that's okay. I'm not here to dissuade you from loving her work. I simply want to contrast her worldview with the worldview of Christ. And I'm going to do that by contrasting some of her quotes with some of those of C.S. Lewis. And I picked C.S. Lewis because he was a Christian she had a particular hatred for. She called him a monstrosity. She called him a cheap, awful, miserable, touchy, social, metaphysical mediocrity. That's a lot of adjectives. So she didn't like C.S. Lewis, didn't like his writings. And they got that from her notes she made in reading one of his books, The Abolition of Men, and that was in her notes. And so there's a lot more I can't say in church that she said about him. So maybe it bothered her that he sold 200 million copies of his books and she sold 29 million. I'm just kidding. I don't think that's probably it. I think it's because his writing, his thinking, and his life could not have been any different than hers. She invented a philosophical system called objectivism. She wrote one time, by the grace of reality, I'm not sure how reality can have grace, but by the grace of reality and the nature of life, man, every man, is an end in himself. He exists for his own sake, and the achievement of his own happiness is his highest moral purpose. Lewis once wrote, human history is the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. She wrote, why is it good to make others happy? It's good to make others happy when and if those others mean something to you selfishly. Lewis wrote, nothing you've not given away will ever really be yours. Now, obviously, not everything Rand wrote or believed is wrong, any more than everything Lewis wrote or believed is right. But her worldview was upside down, fundamentally. It was based on herself, centered on herself. She said that her epistemology, which is the study of how we know, the basis for knowledge, so how do we know what we know? She said it's all based on sense perception. She was convinced of this, which means anything beyond what she can use her senses to perceive wasn't real knowledge, which ruled out, of course, anything faith-based. Problem is her idea that all knowledge is based on sense perception is what? It's circular reasoning, because that knowledge is not based on sense perception. So she's self-refuting. But let me give you one more Lewis quote to demonstrate why she missed the larger picture of the world as it is. As long as you're proud, you cannot know God. A proud man or woman is always looking down on things and people, and of course, as long as you're looking down, you cannot see something that is above you. Now you see why Miss Rand hated Lewis. Today we're going to look at how Jesus' view of the world was upside down, actually right side up from the rest of the world. And Jesus' view was that God is the end, not man. Relationship with him is our highest good, and serving others, not self, is the path to happiness. We're in Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. So he went back into Galilee, but this time not to do public ministry. Those days were pretty much behind him. he went there to find privacy, because now his focus is on getting his 12 ready for his coming death and resurrection. Because his plan to change the world was to invest in a few people and then lay down his life. So he said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him. So Peter had argued with Jesus the first time he told him he would die, but there are no arguments this time, just continued confusion. They still don't get it. And you might say, what's not to get? It's really not that complicated. Pretty straightforward. He said, I'm going to die. I'm going to raise from the dead. That's exactly what happened. Come on. But it's always humorous when we respond to a question with, oh, that's easy. Because every question you know the answer to is easy. And every question you don't know the answer to is hard. So we, most of us, and I talked to someone in between the first and second service who didn't grow up with the gospel, but most of us grew up with at least some exposure to the facts of the gospel. So this concept is not a totally new thing for us. In addition, the events of the life of Christ, his resurrection, are behind us. And so these comments make some sense, but not everyone who even agrees with the, maybe people who don't agree with the Lord, but they still would have some understanding of what he was talking about. But these guys that he's talking to, they grew up with a totally different view of how God was going to operate, how he's going to bring salvation about. So it's not surprising that what Jesus said continued to be confusing to them. And we should be patient with them, because it's very likely that we have some ideas of how God operates that are incorrect as well. And these wrong ideas bring confusion in our life, because life doesn't turn out like we expected to. Like I just talked about, when we see green, red lights when we're begging God for green lights. And so one of the misperceptions that we often have, and we may not think this way theologically, but we live this way practically, is when difficulty comes to our lives, we immediately ask, what did I do wrong? How have I offended God? Now, obviously, we should look for sin in our lives and confess it, but very often Christians sort of live in their lives as if karma is real. If I'm good, God will keep trouble from me. If there's any trouble, it means I've offended God. So we can give these guys a break for having a less than complete perfect picture of how God operates. And the Lord had been teaching them in parables for a long time, and now he switches over to very direct teaching. So they're probably looking for some hidden meaning in his straightforward talk. That most Jewish people at that time would have believed in a resurrection of the righteous dead at the end of the age, but he was talking about being raised from the dead in 3 days. This is very confusing. So they're probably thinking, okay, what's the trick? What's the hidden story here? But there wasn't one. It was straightforward. And no one had the courage to ask him to explain. Maybe they didn't even know what questions to ask. Likely they didn't want to look stupid. Who in here couldn't empathize with that? But whatever the reason for their fear, it becomes clear that they're unable to understand the Lord's remark because they were so occupied with themselves. They were arguing about which one was the greatest among them, as the Lord is teaching them about what real greatness looks like. They came to Capernaum. While he was in the house, he asked them, so what were you guys arguing about on the road? You know, they kept quiet because they were arguing about who was the greatest. So he's talking to them about his sacrifice, and they're having this discussion about which one of them is the greatest. So Jesus knew what they were talking about. And this was not deceptive. This was how he used questions to bring truth to light. It's like God in the Garden of Eden asking Adam and Eve, where are you? He knew their geographic location. He was asking a question to lead them to truth discovery. That was a pretty common way of teaching at the time, not as common today. And they were embarrassed by his question, so they kept quiet. So it's not surprising they couldn't understand what the Lord was saying when he was teaching them about his sacrifice, when they're so caught up with who's great. It's hard for the truth of the gospel to sink in when men are arguing about their own greatness. So in their minds, they'd hitched their wagons to the Star of Stars, Messiah. They're all on their way up, and now he keeps talking about these gloomy things, being betrayed, outcast by the powers that be, suffering and death. And I know how the human mind works. When we hear things that we don't want to be true, we often will not accept them as true. I don't want that to be true. I can't hear that. Let's talk about something more interesting. Let's talk about us. Let's talk about me. So this had to be exasperating. I would think Jesus would be ready to get rid of this bunch and start over, but not so. His plan, his only plan to change the world, were these guys. There was no plan B. And so instead of getting rid of them, he assumed the position of a Jewish rabbi. He sat down and he declared class in session. Setting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. He took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not just welcome me, but the one who sent me. So the master teacher begins his instruction with a revolutionary principle. What is to most of the world an absurd idea? And that is, if anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and servant of all. Now, this is Donald Trump's main operating principle in life. I'm just kidding. If you love Donald Trump, that's fine. But this doesn't even make sense to them. If you're last, clearly you're not first. And if you're first, you're the best. And if you're the best, you're being served. You're not serving people. Not so, Jesus said. The world's upside down. Then he uses a visual aid. He takes a little child into his arm, and he says, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And not just me, but my Father. And so here's a sweet picture of Jesus holding a child and telling them what true greatness looks like. Now, I can tell you that Jesus didn't snatch up some kid who's crying and use him as a prop. That's not what happened. My well-grounded assumption is that this kid was already hanging out next to Jesus. Why? Because the pure in heart are going to hang around the purer in heart. And most likely they're back in Peter or Andrew's house. Maybe this is one of their kids. And Jesus may be the only adult who was paying attention to this kid. And I can tell you, if he'd been in the home before, which was likely, this child had already gotten a hug from Jesus, probably already gotten a story from Jesus, and probably already played in the yard with Jesus. You say, how would I know that? Because there's no way Jesus is going to be around a little child and not love the child like a child likes to be loved. No way. So I assure you, this kid wasn't snatched up as a prop. He was already over there. In that society, apart from normal family affection, children were nobodies. No prestige, no power, nothing to be gained from them. So adults were not going to pay attention to them, especially if someone of the Lord's prominence was in their midst. So look at how Mark set all this up. Jesus says, I'm going to suffer and die. The disciples' response is, I don't get it. Let's talk about who's the greatest among us. And then the Lord teaches them about true greatness as he's loving a child that likely nobody was paying attention to. So this is a contrast. Extreme form of selflessness. I'm going to lay down my life for my friends. And then over here, the disciples' blatant selfishness. The Lord's saying putting other people first, starting with a mere child, means we're putting God first. It's likely this child was forgotten by all but Jesus. They were all focused on their own greatness, and then they're focused on what? Their embarrassment about having been found out talking about their greatness. Meanwhile, what's the great one doing? He's situationally aware. He's teaching them and loving a child. How is he able to be situationally aware? Because he's not thinking about himself. He's not consumed with himself. It's hard to overestimate how profound a reversal this is. Their world and our world is jockeying for position. What can I get from you? How can you serve to my advantage? A world of convincing others of my own worth, my own brilliance, self-marketing, optics, how do I look, rather than who am I? Who am I becoming? One time I spent some time with a man who had not been a part of a church, but had been very competitive in the business world, and after several meetings, he said, I finally figured out why you're asking me questions about my life. And I said, okay. I was surprised by that because I thought it was self-evident. He said, you want to get to know me. And I was even more surprised because he was saying this like it had news value to it. And I said, yeah, that's right. Why is that odd to you? He said, well, in my world, there's only one reason to try and get personal information from someone. It's to be able to use that information to your advantage to gain control over them. And that's how most of the world lives. But Jesus said, no, the right side approach to the world is to put other people first. And in this passage, and in fact, in all of his life, the Lord is unconcerned with what anyone thinks of him. He is never playing for any crowd. He's always being Jesus, unconcerned with looking a certain way. So here in the narrative, we see Jesus, the great one, in a room full of self-proclaimed great ones, paying attention to themselves while he's paying attention to a child. Then he says, this is how you pay attention to God. And this is not just about the importance of children, and they are important. It's about seeing the world as it really is. So what are some implications or applications for us? Well, I can tell you that the obvious and ongoing application of Mark's gospel is the gospel. We call it Mark's gospel because it's now a genre of literature about the gospel. So he wrote his book to explain to people the good news of Jesus. So the the necessity and reality of his death and resurrection. So the main application of the whole book of Mark is not some fun life applications. It's the gospel, the centerpiece of human history. Let's go back to Ayn Rand. This is from a 1964 interview. She said, according to the Christian mythology, Christ died on the cross not for his own sins, but for the sins of non-ideal people. In other words, a man of perfect virtue was sacrificed for men who were vicious and who were expected or supposed to accept that sacrifice. If I were a Christian, nothing could make me more indignant than that. The notion of sacrificing the ideals of the non-ideal or virtue device, and it is in the name of that symbol that men are asked to sacrifice themselves for their inferiors. So I would say, no, Miss Rand, if you became a Christian and God captured your heart, a man of perfect virtue sacrificing for non-ideal men would make you not indignant, but would make you worship. Because you and I are those non-ideal people that the man of perfect virtue sacrificed for. Look at what Paul said about her and others who see the world as she did. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. George Bernard Shaw, Irish playwright, he won a Nobel Prize and an Oscar, only one to ever do that. And I say this very, very, he was no fan of Christianity, and that's putting it very mildly. In his will, he wrote that no one should imply in any of the ceremony that he accepted any religious beliefs, and his memorial should not, quote, take the form of a cross or any other instrument of torture or symbol of blood sacrifice. So the cross of Christ is folly to many, but to us, nothing is more precious. Paul said, where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached, the life, death, resurrection of Christ, to save those who believe. So the largest application of the passage today and every passage in Mark is the gospel itself. The life, death, resurrection of Jesus Christ is a centerpiece of human history. And if you miss that, you don't just miss the point of Mark 9 or Mark, you miss the point of human history and life itself. But let's go to some lesser secondary applications. What else can we take to heart from this passage? One, people are his plan. To quote Robert Coleman in his great book, The Master Plan of Evangelism, men were his method. And Jesus gave the bulk of his life to train these 12 men, and in addition, he invested some extra in three of the 12. And his plan then, his plan now, is to use us to impact the world, to be people who know and love God and make God's love known. So yes, Miss Rand, we're called to sacrifice our lives for others, but here's where she was confused. We never sacrifice ourselves for our inferiors. Only Christ could do that. We can't, because we have no inferiors. We're all inferior to Christ and equal in our need for each other. And this brings us to our second thought for consideration. People were his plan, and yet people are often the largest barrier to the gospel. Nietzsche said, in truth, there was only one Christian. He died on the cross. Our friend Shaw said, Christianity might be a good thing if anyone ever tried it. That was his perspective. Oz Guinness wrote that in his view, hypocrisy was second only to the problem of evil and suffering in terms of being a stumbling block for people in the gospel. So here's my point. If we're his plan, he's got a poor plan. Look at us. But I'm being facetious. Of course he doesn't have a poor plan. He's brilliant. So how are we to think about this? First of all, the truth doesn't depend on our ability to defend it or to live it. There's an important difference between the source of a truth claim and the standard by which that claim is measured. So someone who could be a person of no character, completely unreliable, and say something that's true. Someone could be a person of great moral character and say something that's false. There's a difference between the source and the reliability of the truth claim. So if the whole world proclaimed Christ and lived consistently in line with his teaching, that would not make the gospel true, just popular. If no one in the world believed or lived the Christian life, that would not make the gospel false, just unpopular. So truth is independent of our own personal beliefs or actions. So Paul said, we don't preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ is Lord. We don't preach ourselves. We preach an objective reality. Christ is Lord, period. So truth is independent of us. But we're not off the hook, because the next thing he says is, and ourselves as servants for Jesus' sake. And Jesus said, by this all men will know you're my disciples, by how you love one another. So clearly, truth does not depend on us. thankfully. However, we can make the truth appear more or less real, more or less compelling by our lives. So let's think about this some more. We need to be pointing people to Jesus. We need to be proclaiming him, not ourselves. Because no one has ever seriously accused Jesus of hypocrisy. And even if they did, even in a hostile crowd, they would be laughed out of the room, because whatever Jesus was, nobody thought he was a hypocrite. So we can't be like the disciples who were proclaiming their own greatness. We point to and we proclaim the greatness of Christ. And then the follow-on, well then, aren't people going to measure the credibility of our truth claim by us? Yes, they are. Truth doesn't depend on us, but we can make it appear or less credible. So we feel this tension, don't we? 19th century author, pastor Robert Murray McShane, when he was being praised for his saintliness by a woman in his church, he said, "Madam, if you could see in my heart, you would spit in my face." He understood what was in his heart. Now, let me give you a warning. That can be overdone. It can get to where every compliment is deflected with a humility that starts looking like, "I'm very proud of how humble I am." So you want to watch that. If someone compliments you, it's a good idea normally just to say thank you. But maybe for you, it's not just in your heart where you see hypocrisy. Maybe it's the actions that you believe make you a hypocrite. You look at how you've lived your life, what you said, what you did last week or yesterday. In a brief review, Jesus took the word hypocrite, which was a word used for actors in a play, common word, and he borrowed it, and he said, and it turned into something negative after the Lord got a hold of it, because now it means someone who's play-acting at life, play-acting at faith. Pretending, acting like you're someone or something that you're not. So what do we do with this? We're his plan, and then we're the greatest barrier for people coming to the gospel often. Well, I would say understand that imperfection is not the same as hypocrisy. When you're announcing the gospel, you're not announcing that you have arrived. As you proclaim Christ, by default, you're announcing that your greatest need was met by him. You're also announcing that your greatest need continues to be met by him. So when sharing our need for Christ, we're not sharing our own greatness, quite the opposite. But I'm going to tell you, we live in a culturally loaded time. There's a lot of baggage that we have to deal with as believers. In our very recent past in America, it's appeared to people, and sometimes by well-meaning people, sometimes not, but it's appeared that the gospel proclamation is an announcement of how great my life is, my marriage is, my children, my morality, my church, my ideas, my political party are, and a corresponding announcement of how messed up you are for believing anything different. And that's pretty much where we are in our culture right now. Right or wrong, I'm not making any value judgments on the people, on what created that, but that's just where we are. So what people think when they hear the gospel broadly in our culture is, if you will think like I do, dress, talk, act, drive, live, and vote like I do, you'll have as perfect a life as I do. And so what are they going to do when they hear that? They're going to start looking for imperfections to prove that you're not perfect. And then they're going to rejoice when they find him, and they're going to put him on the front page. That shouldn't, I mean, we gnash our teeth at that, but it shouldn't surprise us. Because that approach has been discredited. That's not the gospel. It's never been compelling. We proclaim the greatness of Christ. We must never be like his disciples were on that day. He's telling them of the gospel, and what are they doing? Arguing about who's the greatest among them. So we focus our attention on him, not on self. We don't focus our attention on playing for the crowd. So here's why we can be done with hypocrisy. The pressure's off. The reason why people play act is because they're afraid of people seeing who they are. But we've been accepted. The King James says we've been accepted in the beloved. You're okay. You don't have to play. You don't have to act. You don't have to pose or pretend. You don't have to perform. You've been accepted. And you were accepted while we were sinners. Christ died for you. Accepted as you are. So why pretend to be more than you are? We can come off the stage. We can enter into real life with people. So we don't need to be pretenders, hypocrites, even though we're still messes. 2 Corinthians 3:18 says that we are being changed into the image of Christ with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Spirit. So it's not a done deal. This is an ongoing process. So our focus is not on how we appear, what image we're projecting. Our attention can be on Jesus, who we're becoming. And when this is happening, what it's going to look like is we're going to be growing, we're going to be failing, we're going to be confessing, and we're going to be growing, failing, and confessing. And someone might still accuse us of being hypocrites, but if you're living that kind of life, that's not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy means you're playing a game. If you're living that kind of life, that's no religious game. That's not play acting. We're taking our sin and our joy seriously. We're not playing at it. So the remedy for hypocrisy is not perfection in your heart and in your action, but to be people who remain imperfect and are learning to care most about what Jesus thinks of us. We're not playing for the crowd anymore. That's what a hypocrite does. And Jesus, the perfect one, showed us how it's done. He never performed for the crowds. He was too busy loving the crowds. Let's pray. Talk to God about your life. Ask Him to talk to you about your life. And then we're going to worship Him together some more.